WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's sports news features two big basketball stories. The Nets have made it to the playoffs, and a former player for Northwestern University is expected to plead guilty today in a point-shaving scheme during the Big Ten games back in 1995. Charlie Rosen says this story is nothing new, that gambling and cheating have always cast a shadow over basketball. Charlie Rosen has been writing about basketball for more than 20 years. He's the author of 9 books of fiction and nonfiction about hoops, including The House of Moses All-Stars, The Cockroach Basketball League, and a nonfiction book about the point-shaving scandals in college basketball back in 1951. It's called The Scandals of 51, How the Gamblers Almost Killed College Basketball. His knowledge of the game is grounded in personal experience. Rosen was a record-setting player in college in the 60s. He also coached a number of college teams as well as minor league teams in the Continental Basketball Association. He worked there with Phil Jackson, now the coach of the Chicago Bulls. In his new novel, Barney Poland's Game, Rosen returns to the theme of gambling and the point-shaving episode among college players in the 50s. I asked him how the betting and the game-fixing started.
It was traditional in basketball. The barnstorming teams in the 20s and 30s, like the original Celtics, the modus operandi was to go into a town on Friday night, play an exhibition against the locals, win by just a few points, hang around for our scheduled game Sunday afternoon, and all the locals would say, hey, we could have beaten you if this shot would have gone in or if the referee would have made this call or stuff like that. And a lot of money would be bet. And then Sunday afternoon, the barnstorming team, the Celtics or whomever, would just roll up the score, collect the money, and get out of town a step ahead of the sheriff. So it was really part of the structure of basketball. And as far as college basketball players dealing with gamblers, that was going on since the late 30s, the early 30s, certainly throughout the 40s. And it was at the point where seniors on the basketball team who had developed the connections with the gamblers and what games were they were going to work and how they were going to pick up their money would invite sophomores, the young players, once they proved that they were good enough, invite them into the coterie, and then when they graduated, kind of hand the baton to someone else.
So did these kids just think, hey, everybody's doing it, it's just like cheating on income tax?
Exactly. And for the most part, you did not have to lose a game. If your team was favored to win by 5 points, you just won by 3 points. So it really didn't make any difference. It was a victimless crime. The only people who would lose out would be gamblers who didn't know what was going on. And as you said, everybody was doing it. One of the problems happened, however, there were several famous games at Madison Square Garden where both teams were shaving points. And it was pretty sloppy, passes being thrown all over the place and guys tripping and balls bouncing off of heads and fans in an uproar. Of course, they figured it out. And it was so blatant that there were even gamblers who ran down to the court and were standing under the basket waving $20 bills to remind the players of what. But sometimes it was pretty hard to figure out. We're supposed to win by 4.5 or 3.5, and this team is very difficult to figure out exactly what was going on in some games.
Is it easy as a player to shave points, easy to fake playing badly?
It's very easy. It's very easy if you do it. There's a certain talent involved. LIU, led by the great Sherman White, who was the progenitor of it goes from Michael Jordan back to Julius Erving to Sherman White. He was the first modern player, and his LIU team, sometimes they were favored by 2.5 points or 1.5 points, so that they had to, in order to win the game but still get paid by the gamblers, they had to win by 1 point or 2 points, which is a very delicate thing. So they became very adept. You just miss a pass. you turn your head the wrong way, you start your cut a little early, and the pass goes out of bounds. But mostly where it should have been done, where it was easier to get it done, was on defense. Just let the guy score or get yourself in foul trouble if you're one of the best players on the team and you wind up on the bench. But what sometimes happened was at the end of the game where the situation got critical, you didn't have the space to be sophisticated. You just had to kick balls out of bounds and do a lot of crude stuff.
How did the story finally break?
It broke when a ball player named Junius Kellogg at Manhattan College was approached by two Manhattan ex-players, and asked to shave points. And he went to his coach, and his coach went to the DA, and these guys were entrapped. Poppy and Burns were their names. And they confessed, they broke down and implicated the gambler who, Salvatore Salazzo, who was the main focus of the gambling for the colleges in New York, and it just kind of spread and spread and spread up to a point, although there was a lot of selective justice, let's say, a lot of schools who were implicated, who were doing business, who were turning tricks, as the phrase went, did not get caught for various reasons.
What determined who were the fall guys and who got away?
Well, the big determining factor, and this is really the reason why I wrote the novel. I had written Scandals of 51 back 20 years or so ago, which was a history of the period and of the gambling scandals. And I really couldn't get too much involved in the players who did get away and why they got away for libel reasons. So 20 years later, I wrote a novel, Barney Poland's Game, which allowed me to get inside the situation a little more. And what really happened was that once the Manhattan kids were exposed, Manhattan, which was a Catholic school, certain Catholic authorities, specifically Cardinal Spellman, got in touch with the D.A. Hogan and told him to lay off the Catholic schools. And that's exactly what happened. So most of the Manhattan was the only Catholic school that was exposed in 51. In 61, there were other scandals 10 years later. St. John's was implicated. So really, the Jewish kids and the black kids were the ones who got caught and punished.
So it was race.
It was race, absolutely. And the black kids were the ones who went to jail. The white kids were given the opportunity to join the army instead of going to jail.
You follow the stories of some of these men, and then the book explores this. What happened to them? I understand some went on to the NBA.
No, none of them did. They were all barred from the NBA. The guys who got away went on to the NBA. There are several members of the Basketball Hall of Fame who were point shavers and dumpers. Several very prominent people who are still active in the sports world. Some became very bitter. Only one, Floyd Lane, tried to stay in basketball. He eventually became the coach at City College, which is a school he attended, and was shaving points. He was shaving points there. The rest of them went on to various. One became a dentist. One became a school psychologist. But all of them lived kind of hidden lives, kind of bitter lives. They really didn't want to talk about it. It was the mark of Cain that they carried with them, and it just changed their lives. And it's kind of sad. I played against a lot of these guys about 7 or 8 years after the whole thing broke. The coach, I went to Hunter College, and the coach there went to City College and knew Floyd Lane and Ed Roman, and they would come up to Hunter College and scrimmage against us. And they were great, wonderful, talented players. But what struck me then was the joylessness of their game. They were just robots. They We were young and rambunctious and emotional, and they just they showed no joy in the game. And that's really what got me so interested. Who are these guys? How could they be playing such a wonderful game, such a pure game, and with such a deadened spirit?
My guest is basketball writer and former coach Charlie Rosen. His new novel, Barney Poland's Game, is based on the gambling and game-fixing scandals in college basketball in the 50s. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlie Rosen. He's written 9 books about basketball, fiction, and nonfiction. His new novel is Barney Poland's Game, about the point-shaving scandals among the college basketball leagues in the 50s. There are a number of point-shaving incidents that have happened in the last decade and just in the last year in college and pro basketball. Just this winter, kids at Columbia were arrested. They were involved with betting and organized crime, and also former players for Northwestern University were indicted a few weeks ago for fixing games a couple of years ago. Is this just the same old, same old? I mean, do you see this just repeating itself? It's the same thing that was going on in the 50s, or are the stakes somehow different, or the questions of innocence and guilt also different?
I think the environment has changed a little bit. There's more money at stake in college basketball. Teams making the first round of the NCAA postseason tournament earn $100,000, $200,000 for their school. If they reach the finals, there are millions of dollars in question. Coaches are making millions of dollars in sneaker contracts. Kids are coming into the NBA with $100 million contracts. So the money is sky high. But I think what keeps it going really are a couple of things. The recruiting practices. You have these high-powered Division I coaches whose jobs depend upon their team's success. And there are just so many blue-chip high school players available to be recruited. So there's a lot of underhanded ways of recruiting players, coaches, literally assistant coaches usually, literally going out and recruiting trips with suitcases full of money, grades being changed to get kids into school, other people taking SAT exams for potential basketball players. So kids come into school knowing all this is going on, and there's no real moral authority in the athletic department. The coaches, all these coaches jump from one contract to the next, running after the buck, the big buck. So there's no moral ground there. Plus, everybody talks about, yeah, kids do jump to the NBA and do make a lot of money, but you're talking about the best players in the country. There are 250 Division I schools. Maybe 50 of those 50 players will wind up in the NBA. And what about the other players? Guys who are really good, the best player on their team, or the second best player on their team, but know that they're never going to play in the NBA. They're never going to play in Europe. They're going to play ball for 3 or 4 years. At the end of that time, most likely they won't even have their degrees. Then what do they do? They just see all this wheeling and dealing going on around them, and they say, hey, why not?
You've had some trouble controlling your own temper on the court, to say the least, as a coach, perhaps as a player. So as a coach, when you, for instance, fought hecklers in the stands or cursed out refs, or you once landed in jail for taking a swing at a coach after a game, did you have trouble controlling your temper, period, or was this something that just comes out of behavior on the court, a part of a macho sports mentality?
Yeah, it is certainly a macho sportsman attitude. But I think coaching is even worse, because when you're playing, you're out there running around, you can let it out. You can smack somebody, they smack you, you can run and jump and just fly all over the place. When you're coaching, you're wearing a tie and jacket, and all you can do is stand up, walk 2 steps, come back, and sit down. So it's just very, very frustrating, especially in the CBA, which is a minor league, where these kids are just interested in getting into the NBA, getting into the big money. So they're not interested in doing what you tell them to do. They're out for themselves. They don't care about team play. So you're fighting the players. You're fighting the fans. You're fighting your owners sometimes who don't who don't want to spend money. I had an owner who, rather than spend the money to fly in a player that I needed, bought new outfits for the cheerleaders because he had some kind of interest in one of them, shall we say. So it's a crazy situation. Nobody wants to be in the CBA, and it's very, very frustrating. And your job, your livelihood, depends on these players doing the right thing. They don't want to do the right thing. The even the referees are training for the NBA, so they have to show that they have complete control of the situation, and they're very arrogant in the way they conduct their business. You can't talk to them, and all of this pressure really kind of distorts your personality, or it puts. It focuses on the weak spots in your personality. It's just like the weak spot in a tire. You know, that's the spot that's going to blow out. The same thing in your personality. And I, for various reasons, I was involved in the dissolution of a long, unhappy marriage. So I had a lot of anger. Some of it was repressed and some of it was not. So that was really my weak spot. And that's where it came out. But I stuck up for my players. And they appreciate that. And even when I took a swing at that coach, who deserved it, by the way, my players supported me, and players on the other team supported me. Which is not, you know, that I condone what I did, but under the circumstances, I'm probably not ashamed of it. 10 years later, other coaches have done worse.
You played at Hunter College in the '60s. How has the game, the actual playing, evolved since you were on the courts?
Well, when I was a kid, I do remember the old leather basketballs with the raised laced seams, which were not perfectly round and didn't always bounce straight up. If you bounced the ball and it hit a seam, it would come up crookedly. And if you try to throw a pass, it would not go true. So it was almost like playing with a shot put. So it was very, very strange. The game was slower in those days. It was much, much more physical. I think we were more basically sound because we didn't have the talent to just jump over somebody or outrun somebody or make all these outrageous moves. So we our games were restricted. There were coaches, Nat Holman at City College was famous for only allowing certain shots, the layup, the hook shot, and the set shot. And there's a scene described in Barney Poland's game, which happened at City College during a practice where a defensive player fell down, sprained his ankle, and the guy he was guarding had the ball, abandoned the offensive pattern and drove to the basket and scored. And Holman was screaming and yelling, you have to go through the pattern. That doesn't exist nowadays. It's not, coaches don't have as much control over their players nowadays. But these kids are so talented. There's more of a focus on playing basketball, so more kids are playing basketball at an earlier age, and they're more advanced than we were.
Players didn't used to dunk then, although they could, right?
If you dunked the ball during a game, it was considered to be the ultimate insult. And if you were foolish enough to dunk during the game, you had to watch yourself because somebody's going to knock you down from behind or take your legs out. There was going to be retaliation. So you were a hot dog. You were a show off if you dunked.
You teach a workshop at the Omega Institute with Phil Jackson called Beyond Basketball. What's Beyond Basketball? What do you cover? Uh-huh.
Well, I also teach one by myself in the middle of the summer. And then the one I do with Phil is a benefit for Eddie Mast's family, who's an old buddy of ours, was Phil's roommate with the Knicks. Basically, the guiding light of this workshop is that basketball is a spiritual game. Anything that a person with a spiritual consciousness undertakes to do has a tremendous spiritual content. Basketball, too. Basketball, it's five players on one team adjusting to each other, losing their egos for the sake of the community, of the whole. It's really knowing what you can do, knowing what you can't do, making decisions on the run, getting in a flow where really you're beyond thinking and you're just reacting with each other. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's, I know most people think of sports as, well, the good guys against the bad guys, the team I root for against the other guys. But it's, it doesn't have to be that way. What we try to teach is that basketball is 10 players playing one game. And it can be a very fulfilling experience to play, and certainly the coach. It's very rare when it happens, but you can cultivate the kind of attitude that that can bring that situation about.
I want to thank you so much for talking today. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Barbara, for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
Charlie Rosen's new novel is Barney Poland's Game. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.